working. So Hare Krishna, everybody, and welcome to the Hangout. Thank you for hanging out with us in the Hangout. So thank you, Miraj, as well, for hanging with us in the Hangout this year.
Thank you for the
It's all a pleasure. So please don't mind me with my phones. We are the techno generation, and I've got all my questions on here. As opposed to pen and paper. So, our session is hanging out with His Holiness Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj. And we're going to be finding out more about Maharaj and his transition over the years from 20s to 30s and so forth. And the different eras and stuff that we're going through and dealing with. So if anybody needs to bring in prasadam, if you need to drink anything, I mean, feel free. This is the Hangout. There's a few house rules of, you know, just behave half decently when we're talking up here. But don't feel shy if you need to bring in food. Come in with your shoes if you need to. There's cake pops that our wonderful team has made as well, so please indulge. And don't forget to write your message on the wall. So if you haven't, before you leave, please write your message on the wall for the Hangout, and we're going to do another string of messages as well. So let's get to it. So, Raj, you've been in this Bhakti Yoga process for quite some time. Tell us, why Krishna, and how is it that you're so here in front of me now that we're having this conversation?
Okay. Why Krishna? Well, I was a frustrated young man. When I was about 19, 20, particularly 20, going into 21, very dissatisfied with the world and with the people running the world and religion. I was brought up as a type of a Christian, but I couldn't take it seriously. And on top of all of that, I was frustrated with myself for being sort of a bit useless and not being able to find any real solutions or real positive alternatives. I tried a number of things. I tried surfing. It's not the answer to the questions of life.
Very good, sir.
And listening to the great musicians and singers of the day, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, and others. And I thought maybe they, actually I really thought, maybe they had the answers. But unfortunately, they also didn't have the answers. They really didn't. And it seemed they were just as confused as me, or maybe more so, I don't know, but they were roughly in the same boat. Just they were much more influential. And so we were going, as one devotee wrote a song actually, busy going nowhere. We were busy going nowhere. And one day, it had not really built up to the highest point of frustration, although it was building. But one day, I was walking around the university in Auckland. I was studying there in a very casual type of way. not serious at all. But I was walking around the university with a friend, and who should I see but Srila Prabhupada? There's a whole story to it. I heard two of us walking along. I heard a sound like the ringing of little bells, I thought. It turned out, of course, to be cartels. I turned around. There was Srila Prabhupada, about maybe 15 meters away, something like that, with some of his disciples, and walking more or less towards me. And Prabhupada looked really regal and effulgent and very deep. And when I saw Srila Prabhupada, this thought just entered my mind. He is dressed in effulgent, shining, rich colored saffron silk robes. Young girls dancing, one on either side throwing rose petals under his feet. And the thought just entered my mind, this must be like heaven. Just spontaneously, without really thinking about it at all. It was just an immediate reaction. And then Prabhupada gave a talk. And like I say, things had not built up to the, or gone down to the lowest point, but they were well on the way. And after seeing Prabhupada, I didn't realize the impact that Srila Prabhupada had had on me. It was only after I'd become a devotee that I realized or began to get some clearer understanding of the effect that he'd had on me. But what happened is that immediately afterwards, like the next day, the following days, and this was April 72, through till the end of the year or thereabouts, was that everything in my life started getting worse. And I started getting more clear understanding of what was wrong with material life, how it was a waste of time and just not worth the trouble, and how I was not making any progress. Even though I was becoming more and more focused that I wanted to develop spiritually. It's a long story. We don't want to go into all the details. But basically like that, I was getting a clear understanding. I had to develop spiritually, but I really didn't know how. So I went to London by ship and arrived there in December 72. And I was visiting some like alternative bookshops, even occult type bookshops. And you know, I had seen Prabhupada on the ship. I met someone who was like a devotee. Or a couple of people, actually, who were like devotees. They encouraged me to visit the temple of London, but I didn't know where it was. I was in one of these, it's called the Aquarius bookshop. I think it's still there. Just a little near Oxford Street, main street of central London. And I was really getting vivid realization that material life is just too much, really too much, and there has to be a better way, but still unable to find it, other than just understanding I needed to spiritualize my life somehow. So there I was in the Aquarius bookshop, and I asked them, where's the Hare Krishna temple? And they said, oh, it's just around the corner. It was around one corner and the next corner, directly on the upper side of the block, literally. So I went there. I just walked straight around, and I found the temple in Berry Place, number 7, Berry Place. And I walked in, and I was thinking, this is it. This is where I'm going to find spirituality. This is where I'm going to find a spiritual master. I really got that idea. I need a spiritual master. So I walked in, and there was one young brahmachari. I was 21. He must have been 21, 22, at the most 23. And I walked in, and I asked him, are you a spiritual master? And he just looked at me for a couple of seconds, and he said, you look really spaced out. Which was not encouraging. But I just, you know, just didn't bother. It only half registered. And then off he went, and I was there, just inside the door at the entrance. And who should come down the stairs but Subhag Swami. At that time he was Subhag Das Brahmachari. He is a Bengali devotee who joined in London a couple of years before, maybe 71. So I asked him, are you a spiritual master? And he said no, but he was very nice about it. And he said, just come with me. And we went into the temple room, which was just right by the entrance. We went into the temple room. There was the Radha Krishna deities, Radha Nandanishwara. And he asked me, do you know who they are? And somehow, I don't know how, but I knew. This is Radha and Krishna. Maybe I'd seen a photo before, I don't know exactly. But. And then he asked me if I knew the Hare Krishna mantra, which I knew, because it had been very popular. And then he preached to me in a very gentle way, in a very kind way, actually, in a very, you know, mature way, the way that people should be preached to when they first come. Not like, you look really spaced out. But just very nice and helpful, and because he, I don't know if many of you are familiar with Subhag Maharaj, but he's a real gentleman. He's a real gentleman. And just such a wonderful disciple of Srila Prabhupada. So then I started visiting. So I was there already, so I spent a good period of several hours even. Yeah, several hours. After a few hours, well, I bought a set of Krishna books, paperback. They came in a box, 3 books, smallish, in a box, a package, and very nice. I bought a set, put them down, came back a little later, they were gone. And I asked, someone just took them. So I asked them, can you give me another set of Krishna books? And they said, well, no. If you want another set, you'll have to buy it. Okay. But then there I was, and meeting different devotees and sitting down and speaking to them a little. Generally, they were all very nice. They were all very nice. And then one devotee came up to me and said, would you mind helping? So I thought, that's a little strange, I'm a guest. You know, or can't you sort of run yourselves. Why do you need me to know? But anyway, I said, okay. And he wanted me to wash the bathrooms and toilet. And I thought, wow, that's really extraordinary. You know, I mean, yes, how can you do this? But I didn't. But very interesting thing happened, and very important thing. I started cleaning, first of all, the main bathroom upstairs in the Brahmachari quarters. And so I'm cleaning with a rag and a bucket of water. And then I found I was feeling very happy all of a sudden, and I couldn't understand why. And I feel more or less exhilarated. Oh, it was really quite an experience, actually. Just like surcharge with energy. And because I didn't like working, I had retired as far as I was concerned. I was 21 years and 4 months, or 3.5 months. As far as I was concerned, I was not going to work again for the rest of my life, because I just thought this whole way of life is just cheating. It's just rotten. It's just a complete deviation from anything of value, like deeper value. So, but there I was, cleaning. And then I realized, oh, I feel very good. I feel very good. And I couldn't understand why. But I remember thinking to myself, yes, I don't want to work again. Okay. But working for Krishna, this seems nice. It seems really nice. So later that evening, I met they took me to meet the temple president, whose name was Dhananjaya Prabhu. Yeah, who's a very senior devotee in ISKCON and a very wonderful devotee nowadays. So we started talking, and he asked me, what's your name? And I told him my name, material name. And he said, oh, we have the same surname, the same family name. And I thought, wow, that's, maybe it's a sign. I was really into signs, you know, different omens, you could say. I was really into that sort of thing. Messages from like higher sources. And I thought, wow, maybe this is a sign. You know, I was already feeling pretty good about it. But I thought, maybe this is a sign that I should really take it more seriously. And then he told me the story of how, because our family names, they're slightly, not so obscure, but slightly obscure, old Scottish name. Yeah. One of the old, it's a sub-clan of the Bruce clan. And so he told me the story of how his family had got the name. It was exactly the same story that my father had told me about how our family had got the name. Wait, so let's go again for you.
Next interview.
Yeah, from Robert the Bruce, who was about 1,000 years ago, but a good several hundred years ago, the last king of independent Scotland. So, and I thought, wow, it's really a sign. It's a super sign. Oh, yeah. So I thought, I got to get into this. This is it. This is, you know, it's meant to be. Because, you know, in those days, the hippies, they're into all these types of ideas, kind of quasi-spiritual, quasi-subtle, you know, yogic type ideas, very quasi, but still connected with all those things. So I thought, yeah, that was it when he told me the story. I got to get into this. That's what I got to do. So then I started coming every day, just for a few days,
to the temple,
and just getting into it more and more, and different other things happened, which were like, made me think that it's meant to be, that sort of thing. And then a few days later, it was actually Sunday, the 7th of January, 1973, I moved into the temple.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Krishna. Yeah. And initially, it was a bit of a struggle. Getting into the chanting wasn't easy. It took me a few days. But after a few days, suddenly I got into the chanting, and suddenly my frustrations and anxieties and all these concerns I had about so many things just dissolved. I realized one day that I don't have any anxiety. I'm out of anxiety for the first time in quite a while. You know, I'm sort of like free and easy. And then I understood, yeah, it's Krishna consciousness. It works. It really works. So then I got into it more and more. I did different services. I did a number of services, but first really significant service, I think, was book distribution, going out every day. And I would do book distribution for a few years as my main service, really, up until early 1976. Then I started running the British BBT, printing books, yeah, for the book distribution in England. And then I came down here to South Africa in January 1980. So I was then 28. And I remember having my 30th birthday party at the house of Mother Suniti in Pietermaritzburg. I don't know if any of you know the late Mother Suniti and her husband Uttanapad and their three children. What are their names? Alakananda, Ranti Dave, and Shampyari. So yeah, and there are photos. The family still has photos from my 30th birthday party. They've got them. Yeah. So then I'd come down here, and now I was into my 30s. And first of all, I ran the Cater Ridge Temple, ran it into the ground. There was a lot of ground too, and 20 acres. So, I mean, we didn't do too bad, but we did end up with a debt. And then went into like a real major other phase that was collecting to build the Radharatnath Temple. This went on for 3 years, from April 82 till July 85. So now, you know, this is like 31 to 34 years old, 35 years old. Yeah. Just out there. We went out to distribute, to sell paintings. Painted initially paintings from Korea, then paintings from Hong Kong, which we called Honky Tonkers. And they were dirt cheap. They cost like less than 10 rands each, and we'd sell them for 90 rands. Yeah. And so we really got into that. That was a big thing, a very big thing. Practically the whole Yatra got into selling paintings, including Mother Divya Rupa, who just turned around and said, yeah, she was one of the leaders. So we had to take off our neck beads. We had to, I'm just telling them how you were selling paintings. Oh yeah, that's true. And yeah, we had to take off our neck beads, cut off our seekers. I remember the day I cut off my seeker. We were in Velcom, in the Free State, yeah. And so I cut off my seeker that day. Maybe the Prabhu took it. I don't know if he still has it. I don't know. So, yeah, and we went into complete disguise. Total disguise. Grew our hair, kami clothes, and selling these paintings all over South Africa, from Cape Point to Bait Bridge. We went to Bait Bridge too, and everywhere in between. Oh yeah. And all the way up into what was then Southwest Africa, all the way up to Etosha we went, and all the places, you know, Windhoek, Sumer, and so on. One place I remember, it was in the Northwest Cape, Northern Cape. Anyway, whatever it's called, near Springbok. No. Anyway, what's the name of the big town? No. Upington. Yeah. It was called Hotazel. So we went to Hotazel. Yeah. And we went everywhere. And we went to Springbok. And out from Springbok, on near the coast, was a place called Nabebe. Look on the map, it's still there. Nabebe. It's like a ghost town. And that's where Krishnanandas, if you know him, he's from Nabebe. He lives in Durban. So we did that till 85. Then we opened the temple, Durban Temple, Rotorua, in 85. And in, it was what, September, October. Yeah. And then that was another new thing. Then I became regional secretary and temple president for what was in those days Transvaal, Gauteng, yeah, living at Mulder's Drift. So I was doing all that sort of thing for some years. Then this, now we're in the later 80s, so it's my late 30s. And then around the time I turned 40, I started traveling more. Yeah, traveling and preaching. It started in 91. I went on Padyatra in England, and then on Holland, Belgium, and France. Padyatra for 3 months, just walking. We walked from Liverpool to London, and then took a boat over to Amsterdam, and then walked from Amsterdam down into France, just across the border into France, just doing Harinam. and some preaching, but more just hanging out, just walking along with a box cart. It was amazing. Yeah, and we had to change oxen every country because the live animals can't cross the borders. So we were getting all these new oxen. And one I remember, I mean, they were all characters. Because one I remember, he just had a sedentary lifestyle. He never practically moved a muscle his whole life, except to chew. Now he's hooked up to the car, the deity cars, and he just didn't know. What's the smell behind me? What's going on here? And the devotee, his name's Parasaram, he's still doing this program. Amazing devotee. He sort of flipped the reins. It's the normal way, you know. The animals get the message right, time to go, but not this one. And so Parasaram gave him a whack on the backside. And I remember I was watching this. And this poor oxen, this like embarrassed look came on his face like, "How dare you?" And he took one step and stopped. Then he eventually got the idea and he started walking. But so now we're walking through the countryside, and on the left or right, anyway, on one side there was a field with crops or something, kind of luscious green color, just really like oxen heaven. And he saw that. And he didn't understand, you know, you got to stay on the road and just keep going, following the road. He just turned off and just went. For this field with the deity cart, you know, almost went over, but it didn't. And then we brought him back on the road and it was like, "Oh, what do you think you're doing?" Oh, this was nice. That was the day we crossed over the border, I think, into Belgium. And we were staying the night in the center of Antwerp, which is the second city of Belgium. Right, I mean, literally just off the main street in the city center. And there's this oxen, it's his first day. And he's done like at least 10 kilometers or maybe a bit more. And he was finished. So we had to make a turn off the main road in the middle of all this traffic to go into, it was a monastery that we were going to stay in. So, but he decided, "Look, I've had enough. I've just had more than enough." He just lay down in the street. And Parasaram whacked him a few times. No luck. I'm just taking a break. So we got a few 25-liter buckets of cold water and threw them on him. And that, you know, that he got out of him, went off the road. But it was quite an experience. Yes, I believe so. You know, actually, we used to do that sort of thing sometimes. I wouldn't want to tell too many secrets from the past.
I'll get it out in due time.
Someone might write a book about it or blackmail us. But that was 91, so I was 40. I turned 40 on the Padyatra. And then 40 and through my 50s, I was traveling and preaching. Yeah. That was 91. In 98, I became a GBC. And so I had certain specific areas to oversee and keep tabs on to some degree. So since that time, you know, first of all, I was traveling here and there and many places, a fair number of places. I was going to America. I was going to some places in Europe, some places in Southeast Asia. But then I was given a zone. You wouldn't be aware, Govardhan Prabhu probably is, that I have the most spread out zone of any GBC member in the world. It's my only real claim to fame. That is Southern Africa, Mauritius, then the Baltic States, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, it's kind of East Europe, almost on the border with Russia. Then Northwest Russia, north of Moscow, and sort of towards the western border of Russia. And then all of Siberia, which is central Russia, to fly there to the beginning of it from Moscow. You know, from here to Moscow is two flights. One is 8 hours, and the other one is like 4 hours, 5 hours. And then to the first place in Siberia that I'm involved in, that's about 4 hours. And the most distant place in Siberia where I'm involved, from Moscow, that's about 7 to 8 hours, at least 7, from Moscow. Yeah. So a very widespread zone. And basically, you know, I was from 91 till 98, I became a GPC member. I was just traveling. And I had some responsibilities in South Africa also. I was, where were we? I was overseeing Transvaal, Gauteng. I was temple president in Radharadna for a while. But then I really started traveling more. It was in the late 90s, and then I became a GBC member. Bhakti Vigyan Maharaj asked me actually to become a GBC member for parts of Russia. So since then, since say 1998, means like I'm now 47 years old, roughly. I've only been visiting those places where I have GBC responsibilities, except for a couple of other areas which I've been going to for some time. Malaysia, Singapore, a little bit, and one other part of Russia, which was the first part of Russia I ever went to. I went to Russia for the first time in 93, and then really became involved in 94. Yeah. So now I'm 64. And there was an old Beatles song, some of you might know it, "When I'm 64." And now I'm 64. And the mood of that song, it's like, now I'm an old man. And I'm just, you know, my life is over. And I'm just a relic, some sort of, what do you call it? There's a word begins with O. Anyway, just some sort of hangover from the past, just waiting to die, filling in time. But I can say now, I'm still traveling a lot. Last this year still, I've studied Russian on and off for like 20 years, at least 15 to 20 years, say 20 probably. But last year I did a very serious Russian course. I had been thinking, because, you know, I sort of partially know Russian, not well at all, but to some degree. And I was thinking, should I actually learn Russian? Actually learn it? But then I was thinking, look, you know, I'm over 60. It's too late. It's too late for doing something like that. But then I thought, you know, why? Why think like that? Why think like that? And so I did a very serious Russian course for 1 month, 6 days a week, 3 hours a day, plus about 3 or 4 hours of homework. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, it was. And this year, coming 2016, well, I was doing it with Niranjan Maharaj. So he and I, next year, we're going to do a 6-week course of Russian. Very serious study. We asked the teacher, how long would it take us at the end of the course, about 1 month. I asked him, how long would it take us to become competent so we can actually speak and understand the language? And he said, 3 months. So we decided, right, 2016, we're going to do 3 months. But, you know, life is too busy, unfortunately. I have to travel too much. So we're going to do 6 weeks. We're going to do 6 weeks next year. Because we're eternal. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if you're 64 or 74. It really doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter at all. It's something for service to Srila Prabhupada. And it really helps in service to Srila Prabhupada. So why not do it? So yeah. Like through my 40s and 50s, more and more I was, say through my 40s, more and more I was getting into traveling and preaching. Through my 50s, I was very much traveling and preaching. Very much. And I'm continuing to this day. And I can tell all of you nice devotees out there in listener land, it's a great way of life. If any of you would like to come with me, just let me know and you can. And we'll have you out there too, preaching and leading kirtan and so on.
When can we eat from us?
Well, we're going to Mauritius on Wednesday. I'll teach you Creole, too. Mauritian Creole.
Well, I love the fact that you mentioned that age is not the limit to stop your learning. I really love that point. So there was a lot that Maharaj went through, and I kind of wanted to dissect a few specifics. So you mentioned you were around 19, 20. When you started having this spiritual awakening.
Yes.
And many are having the same spiritual awakening around the same age. And then some university programs are doing so well in the country.
True.
So, because and well, myself as well in my 20s, many are going through a bit of opposites of age transition. Mm-hmm. And the illusion of we've got the rest of our lives here, so we're not really on the thought of the afterlife, but more on what is our purpose, how do I fulfill it, and what is the path that I want to take to fulfill that purpose. So I love that our audience is varied in each category, because we're going to go through each group in due time. What were some of the challenges, spiritually, because you mentioned you started chanting at a certain point. Because especially when you teach university students, almost everyone is struggling with at least something in their lives, whether it's personal or not directly affected to them, that hinders the spiritual life. So how, I don't know if you want to touch on if you went through any hindrances, and maybe like what were the tools that you used to overcome? Because we often hear, you know, chanting be happy, and yes, there is the potency in the holy name, but realistically or not realistically, practically, what were some of those tools that you used?
Well, you know,
in the 20s.
See, yeah, before I became a devotee and actually started practicing, there were just so many hindrances in the broad sense, just life and me and our incompatibility. And it was terrible, actually, and getting worse. Oh, yeah, it was bad, and it was getting worse. But then I took to Krishna consciousness, and initially, because I was coming, you know, I didn't go through a period of practicing outside the temple, living at home. Not really. It was just a matter of a week or so, yeah, before I decided to move into the temple. So I had chanted a little when I first came to the temple, but not much. I was more talking to people, doing a little service, spending some time like that. But then when I moved in, then, you know, you have to chant every day and follow the morning program. So I had to do that. And because my mind was still in that disturbed, mixed up state, even though I had this resolve that, you know, I've got to become Krishna conscious because it's really the best thing, and it, you know, really seems like it's the solution, the answer. But still my mind was sort of zinging around a lot. And therefore it was difficult to concentrate and focus on the mantra and hear the mantra, because I would chant and my mind would just be thinking of other things. But then after just a few days, it wasn't a long time, I'd say less than a week, yeah, like even 4 or 5 days, I started getting into the chanting of it. Yeah. And then one day after a few weeks, I had a really amazing experience that it just seemed to, you could say, just click. And my mind just became absorbed in the sound vibration. Oh yeah. During the japa period in the temple room, just became absorbed. And what a wonderful experience that was. So that was there. Plus, I mentioned the general feeling as I was engaging in devotional service. Like my problems, my anxieties dissolved. And I remember very clearly one day just realizing, oh, hey, my anxieties have gone. Because there, you know, there were plenty, and they were not nice.
At that moment, how did that feel, knowing?
I felt liberated, that's how I felt. Yeah. I really felt liberated. So, I think it was a combination of all the factors. The underlying factor being the chanting, so much chanting going on, because we would go out in the streets. That's all we did. After breakfast, you know, 9:30, later on again, we'd be out down Oxford Street chanting. Hurry now. We'd come back for lunch, and after another hour, we'd be back out chanting, and we'd come back about 5:30. So it was a good number of hours every single day, Monday to Saturday, of chanting, and then other services, We do. I washed the pots for a while in the kitchen. But I think there was just a general purification taking place. And what I'd advise for devotees in their 20s, or 30s, or 40s, or 50s, or 60s, that really, I'm talking about people who are just kind of beginning, more in the earlier stages, is try to really get into chanting. If you can get into chanting and really get a taste for it and get attached to it and get an experience out of it, it will carry you through, you know, many challenges, problems, and ups and downs like that. Yeah. You know, another thing I just thought of mentioning, and it's more in relation also to the young devotees, I mean, younger in age, who are maybe attending university or just starting in the earlier stages of their working life. You know, I notice among some of our devotees in that sort of stage of life, those stages of life, I notice they have a much greater sense of optimism about their material futures. You know, I'm doing this degree. Wow, it's a good one. Sure. Yeah. And, you know, I got accepted for this somewhere. And, you know, it's good. And then, you know, then they graduate after some time. And now, yeah, wow, I'm going to get the good job and it's just going to be good. You know, I think that's a very fundamental misconception, very foundational misconception. Yeah. All these subjects which you study at the university, you know, generally, or in many cases, they cannot be used in Krishna consciousness much directly, the actual whatever skill it may be, and some of them can't be used at all, like what's his name, Dhruva Maharaj was working at Coburg nuclear power station as a nuclear engineer, and all you could do with that is make an atom bomb.
Yeah.
And it's not so helpful in Krishna consciousness. So, you know, of course, if someone's going to become a grihastha, then okay, sure, they do need some way to make a living, which is in a field which is suitable to them in terms of their psychophysical natures. And so they can earn a decent living and live nicely, not just, you know, on the breadline or, you know, just like a simple laborer. But one shouldn't be too optimistic about it or see it in too glowing terms, how nice it is to become a this or a that, and because it basically means you're learning some science, some particular subject, which is part of the overall general program, I mean, overall in the broadest sense, of furthering the existence of material life in the world. And when you work for one of these companies, you know, you must understand, you are working, generally, you are working for demons who want to sort of destroy this world. Yeah, they're part of a, you know, a program, this general program for destroying this material world, exploiting the people, degrading humanity individually and collectively. And you are now becoming part of it. and you are contributing to it.
Yeah.
So, not that one should necessarily think, well, you know, just, I mean, you can also think as I thought and still do. I don't want to be part of it. I actually am not, I refuse to be part of it. I am just going to be a devotee and just dedicate my life to my own advancement and to trying to help people and help the world in Krishna consciousness. But anyway, if one is going down the sort of the Grihastha route, that's okay. But you should understand what is happening and what it means. What is the purport in reality of what you're doing and where you're going in terms of your career and all that. And that, you know, as Prabhupada would say, making the best use of a bad bargain. Not like, wow, great opportunity to get some great, fantastic job and make lots of money and all that. That's not what it is. It's not what it is. It's making the best use of a bad bargain, actually. And really our goal in life has to be Krishna consciousness. And that if I'm working as, be it as a doctor, you know, curing the materialistic people so they can again engage in sense gratification and activities which will take them to hell better than if they just stayed sick. You get the idea? This is not such an honorable type of position to be in. I cured this person so that he could eat more meat. Pat myself on the back. I cured this person so he could drink more liquor. Congratulations to me. You got to understand, you may have to do it, but you got to at least understand what you're doing and what the implications of what you're doing, what they are. And really keep the Krishna conscious perspective on it. And rather than being, you know, say a doctor, we mentioned a doctor, rather than being a doctor who's also a devotee, whenever there's enough time, but rather be a devotee who, for the sake of bodily maintenance, has to perform the duties of a doctor, you know, despite their shortcomings. So that's my little lecture to all of you youngsters. Anyway,
thank you, Zach. So, one thing that we take away from that is that, you know, it doesn't matter your material age, whether you're 20, 30, 40, 50, it's ongoing. And you're having your spiritual awakening. I mean, don't feel that it's too early or it's too late to make good for the most of a bad bargain. So thank you for that, Maharaj. So in closing, there are many lessons that I would think that you've learned over these years. But what's that one? I don't know if I'm being unfair to you by asking for one, but the pinnacle lesson, if I can call it that grounded you, also because you spoke of, you know, just absorb yourself in the chanting, and that really resolves the problems. But that pinnacle lesson that you still carry with you today.
I think that would be that as one of my godbrothers put it not too many years ago, a little while ago, but it really struck me that he put it well, that the essence of life is service to Srila Prabhupada. Everything else is just detail.
Well, can you Are we recording that, Chandra?
The essence of life is service to Srila Prabhupada. Everything else is just detail.
Whether you're in your 20s, you're in your 60s, and you're having a spiritual awakening, I mean, if you're not convinced of Krishna consciousness and Bhakti Yoga being the process to answer all of your questions, come speak to us for further clarity. And thank you, Maharaj, for hanging out with us. This was so nice. I really enjoyed it. Look forward to having you again in the hangout. Please, can we have you sign our graffiti chalk on the back before you leave? and that's open to everybody as well. And we're going to be doing a round of cake pops before our next session, led by Auntie Reshma Maharaj, and that's soul painting. So, Hare Krishna.
Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai.
Hare Krishna.